Welcome to the Last Post Radio Show podcast series. You can listen to podcasts anywhere and at any time, making it easy to fit into your daily routine. And we hope to become part of your daily routine. And why not, when we have guests like Australian author Stephen Dando Collins? We're here to talk about Stephen's latest book, The Buna Shots, the amazing story behind two photographs that changed World War II. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you, Greg. Great to be with you.
Stephen, this is quite an amazing book with just universal praise. Buna, a village on the coastal plain of northern Papua, was the main base for the Japanese advance along the Kokoda Trail. As we've mentioned previously in conversations, my father actually fought at Buna. Tell us a little about the title, Stephen, in relation to the story in the book about the two photographers, George Silk and George Strock.
Yeah, as you mentioned, Greg, the book is centred on the Battle of Buna Gona, which was December, January 1942-43. And as I've found over the years, it's a battle that a lot of Australians know very little or nothing about. And yet it's been said that that battle had the highest casualty rate of any battle during World War II in any theatre of war. Because not only were there bullets and shells and bombs flying, but the number of people coming down with various illnesses from malaria to scrub typhus and so on was immense. And units that started out with several thousand men would have several dozen by the end of the campaign, fit for duty. And it's a battle that I knew about from a book by Raymond Paul. He was a war correspondent working for the ABC during the campaign. And I was lucky enough to befriend his daughter, Anne Benton, who is an author, was an author. And she gave me a copy of his book about the campaign, and it fascinated me. But it was quite a few years later that I started to delve into it, initially attracted by the photograph that's on the cover of the book, The Buna Shots, of the so-called blinded digger being helped along a track near Buna by a Papuan carrier. And that was really my starting point. But the amazing thing was, when I started to look into the story seriously, which that was about 2011, my wife Louise and I were visiting the Australian War Memorial. At that time, I had a book out about my great uncles during World War One, Crack Hardy, a book that did quite well around Australia at the time. And we were there to find their names, or as many of their names as we could, on the wall and put a poppy up. And as we're doing this, four gentlemen from Papua New Guinea in tribal attire came up. And they were obviously there to attend a ceremony of some kind. And they very kindly allowed us to take their photograph. We thought how amazing to run into these gentlemen on that day. Well, as it turned out, as I later realized, they were descendants of the so-called Fuzzy Wuzzy Angels that I write a book about in the Buna Shots. So the shots that I'm talking about are photographs, and they are two photographs that are said to have changed the course of World War II. One was that one I've mentioned, the so-called blind soldier, and the other one was taken only kilometres away and a few weeks later at Buna Beach of three dead Americans. And the great irony is I discovered I stumbled on the fact that these two photographs were connected. Now, one was taken by a chap called George Silk, a Kiwi working for the Australian Department of Information. His best friend was Damien Parra, who was very well known as an Australian photographer from World War II. And the other guy was another George, whose first name, last name started with S and ended with K as well. His name was George Strock, and he was an American working for Life magazine. And they actually became friends, and their destinies became quite intertwined as the more I delved into the story, which to my amazement, nobody else apparently had come across in all the years since World War II.
Well, it's an honour to Stephen that you've gone and researched this and ended up writing such a magnificent book, because obviously we had become aware, my family, through Dad's service of Buna and the Boona Beach shots were amazing there by Strock, and of course the Blinded Digger shot by Silk. But these were quite interesting characters themselves, Stephen. What happened, Damien Parrow, who you said was a friend of George Silk's, did he resign after Silk's photograph? Yeah. What happened there, from memory? Silk actually went into the Prime Minister's office.
Well, Silk started out, he was a young man of 23, in the first week of 1940, turns up in the office in Canberra of Prime Minister Robert Menzies, and says, I'm here to discuss a matter of national importance with the Prime Minister. And he'd just come across from Auckland, where he'd worked as a shop assistant in a camera shop. And he walked in and he said, I want to see the Prime Minister. And Norman Tritton, the Prime Minister's private secretary, said, well, you'll have to tell me what about. I can't just ush you in to see the PM. And he said, well, I want to photograph the war. And he brought along a portfolio of photographs he'd taken in his spare time in New Zealand, sporting events. And so Tritton said, as he's looking through the portfolio, leave them with me. The PM's meeting with the War Cabinet this afternoon. I'll try to show them to him. Go away. So George Silk went away. He came back at 3 o'clock as instructed. And Tritton said, yes, the PM and the boys, as we called the War Cabinet, PM and the boys were rather impressed. We want you on a train to Melbourne tonight. And Silk said, actually, I'm broke. I spent my last pennies getting here to Canberra.
That's right.
And
that's right,
yeah. He said, no, don't worry about it. Don't worry about that, young man. We'll take care of that. So he gets on a train to Melbourne, and he's there met by Lynn Mapleston, who was the putting together the Department of Information's photographic unit. And he took him to booked him into a hotel, and then took him to a men's outfitters and got him outfitted in an Australian Army officer's uniform, which official war correspondents for Australia wore. Then put him on another train to Western Australia, and he arrives at Fremantle and boards the troop ship Strathaird, and his bunkmate is none other than Damien Parrow. He said, we spoke excitedly for 20 hours nonstop, barely stopping for meals, about photography. And they became the best of friends, and the pair of them covered the war in the Middle East initially together.
Yes, it's such a story. Two great photographers meeting and becoming friends like that. And George Silk had a bit of spunk about him, didn't he, going into the Prime Minister's office?
Oh, well, it got better. He said he was actually, before the war, afraid of guns and terrified of war. So at one point, his boss in the Middle East, in Cairo, was Frank Hurley, the famous World War One photographer, and they didn't get on at all. Hurley had different ideas to Silk and Parra. They wanted to document the war, and they refrained from taking, wherever possible, unless ordered to, taking pictures of officers. They always wanted to take pictures of the men fighting, doing the hard work. Mm. So at one point, Silk got fed up with being held back by Frank Hurley. So he borrows, let us say, a utility truck and drives off to join the British Operation Crusader, which was sent to relieve Tobruk. Parra and Silk had both been in Tobruk at one point, photographing the so-called Rats of Tobruk. And in fact, most of the photographs, the still photographs that we know from of the Australian Rats of Tobruk, were taken by Silk. And so he joins this operation and takes the photograph of the battle in the desert, in the Western Desert, and then becomes separated from the British troops and walks up behind a group of soldiers who he thinks are allies. They're actually German troops in a hole in the ground with a machine gun. And thinking quickly, now he's only armed with a camera, thinking quickly, he reaches down and picks up a rock, which is about the size of a grenade, and says, surrender, I'll blow you to kingdom come. Well, there are 11 Germans in the trench. They all throw down their guns and throw up their hands. Oh. He rushes in and picks up one of their guns and takes it in, and then hands them over to Scottish troops who are pushing out of Tobruk. But a little bit later, he becomes separated again from Allied troops, and he's captured by the German. And he's, I think, a prisoner for about 10 days of the Germans, but then they have to fall back. Now, he was, from all the things we know about Silk, he was very persuasive. So he must have persuaded the German officer in charge of him as a prisoner to let him go. Mm. And not only to let him go, but to keep his cameras. they were German cameras. He had a Rolleiflex camera and a Contax camera.
Boy, oh boy.
Really, expensive German cameras. But he was allowed to go free, and he regained Allied lines. And then after the new Prime Minister, Curtin, the Labour Prime Minister, defied Churchill and recalled most of the Australian troops to defend Australia, Silk and Para were both recalled. Para was sent to New Guinea, first of all, and then after he was pulled out, exhausted, he covered the Kokoda campaign with the very famous images of that campaign, which became an Academy Award-winning documentary film.
Yeah.
But then Silk was sent in to take his place in Papua New Guinea.
Well, that's incredible. That's absolutely incredible. The story about George Silk picking up the rock the size of a grenade and doing that should be in a movie. I think that's absolutely amazing. And I think that's right, of course, because the troops were brought back from the Middle East. The 2nd 10th Battalion, my father was in, which he joined when they were returned from the Middle East and went to Papua New Guinea, Kokoda. That's an amazing story about Silk, and he certainly seemed to have a lot of persuasiveness about him. The other chap, George Strock, and this is another thing that's very similar with them, Stephen, by the sounds of it. George Strock, actually, he like Silk going to the Prime Minister, Strock, correct me if I'm wrong, he went to see Roosevelt at some stage.
Yes, his campaign, if you will call it, ended up with President Franklin D. Roosevelt. Now, Strock was a very different character from Silk. He liked to drink. And he was in Chicago when his boss at Life magazine said, okay, you've been pushing to go to the Pacific. We're sending you with the 32nd Division.
Mm.
Get to San Francisco. There's a place for you in one of the troop ships heading to Australia. So he went on a train called the City of San Francisco. He spent the 35-hour trip in the bar car because George Strock loved to drink. So now the train was called the City of San Francisco, but it didn't actually go to San Francisco. It only went to Oakland, California. But he was lucky enough that the chief barman in the bar car put him on a ferry to San Francisco from Oakland around San Francisco Bay and went with him. Then when he got to Pier 42, Strock was totally out cold, of course, by this stage, and he put him over his shoulder, carried him up the gangplank and deposited him on a troop ship. It was the wrong troop ship, but once the convoy, I think it was 7 troop ships, 3 and 3 US Navy escorts, once it set sail, reported back to Life magazine, your man Strock hasn't turned up on his ship. But then a message comes a bit later. We found him on another ship, so it's all right. So that's how Strong found his way to Australia and to the world.
The more you tell viewers, or listeners, and readers about these two men, Stephen, and your brilliant recounting of this piece of history, it becomes more evident it should be a movie. I tell you what. How did these two amazing photos from Strock and Silk change the perception, the view of World War II in the Pacific?
Well, the thing about, we assume, you know, the Silk photo of the wounded digger, his name was George Whittington, nicknamed Dick Whittington, and the carrier, he's the Papuan carrier, his name was Raphael Imbari, and they didn't identify him until 1972. So his photograph, we assume that, you know, it just appeared and it became famous. Probably the most iconic World War II Australian photo. But it didn't. The Department of Information banned it for being too graphic. And Silk was incensed. And he'd taken a couple of other photographs. He'd photographed the 2nd 10th Battalion, as you mentioned. And he'd taken some photographs of the 2nd 12th in the latter stage of the Battle for Buna, which he considered the best photographs he'd ever taken, and he thought the best photographs of the war. One was, he was standing right, he had no fear. He stood right beside a couple of Australian Bren gunners, and a second after he took one shot, the Bren gunner beside him fell down dead with a bullet in his head from a Japanese gun. And the other one was, the other one was a Vickers gunner's, in the open, sitting behind their Vickers gun, firing at the trees at the Japanese snipers. And the first gunner had been shot and killed, and his body was still there in the photograph. And both those photographs were banned by the Department of Information, and he was incensed. So he wined and dined a young lady from the Department of Information, their only female representative. She was in Port Moresby, and she was a very attractive young lady, he said. And for a long time, he never revealed this. He only revealed this after the war, and he never revealed her name. And I'm still on a search, on a quest to find out who she was, because she was a very plucky young lady. So he wined and dined her at the Officers Club in Port Moresby and got her to agree to help him. So what she did is she sent to the DI, the Department of Information Laboratory in Sydney, asking for prints of his two favourite photos of the Bren gunners and the Vickers gunners. And he, as an afterthought, he said, oh, you might as well get me a shot of the blinded digger and the carrier. And so she got prints of all three, sent through an official order, a requisition order, and the prints came back. She smuggled them to Silk. He smuggled them to Bill Chickering, who was an American war correspondent, who took them to Brisbane, to MacArthur's headquarters, and got them stamped approved by the American censor. He brought them back, gave them to Silk. Silk gave them to George Strock, the American life photographer. Mm. Strock had just taken his photograph of three dead American soldiers on Boona Beach. And he knew well that the Pentagon banned any shots of American dead, and even American wounded. They were very careful about, you know, not showing seriously wounded GIs or Marines or whatever. And he was determined to get it published because he'd found, the American public was very apathetic about the war. They assumed that America, being such a, you know, a great power, they'd win the war by Christmas and it'll all be over, and, you know, we could forget all about it. Mm. But as Strock found, the Japanese were a very, very tough proposition. And so he decided after the Battle of Boona, he was going back to America to get this photograph published. So he took Silk's three prints with him, smuggled them out of New Guinea to Australia and then back to America. And he went to Life magazine with them.
Yeah,
he gave the three Silk shots to his boss at Life magazine. And Life magazine was the first publication in the world to publish the blinded digger shot, which got Silk fired and accused of treason for giving classified information to a foreign power. So that's when Damien Parra resigned from the Department of Information
yeah, that's
and went to
right.
work for Paramount. Went to work for Paramount Newsreels.
Yeah, that's right, Stephen. And to appear in such a prestigious publication as Life, and then of course there were a few people suggesting that Silk was a foreign agent or something like that. That was absolutely incredible. Two of the most graphic photos, and I say that knowingly because they stick in the memory. These are two photographs that when news came out about your book and seeing these photographs, I thought about time, because they're there for historical record and amazing thing. When you spoke about Strock and Silk being different characters, I think we spoke Strock from Dyersville, was it in Iowa? And he was doing movie stuff and magazine. What was it, Modern Screen and Life magazine.
Modern Screen, yeah. So he was a paparazzi before the war, paparazzi, and he you know adopted the paparazzi lifestyle, the movie world lifestyle.
Yes.
But when the war broke out, he was sent to London first of all, and then to Vichy France to cover the war. But he really got a taste for, you know, I want to do the, I want to cover combat, and so that's how he. But he had a very different background to Silk.
Yeah, incredible, incredible. And Silk, of course, as we speak about this, George Silk, he won the US Magazine Photographer of the Year four times, was it, Stephen?
Yep. He became famous through his blind soldier shot, and he was saved by Life magazine. Curtin had him fired and then refused to... when Life magazine put their hand up and said, okay, we'll hire him. He refused to give him official war correspondent accreditation for months. And then when Life magazine said, oh, okay, we'll have to get somebody else to replace Strock in New Guinea. We won't be able to send Silk there because his government won't release him. Only then did John Curtin, you know, who had a reputation for being a really good prime minister in many respects, but he and MacArthur dug their heels in and were determined not to allow the Silk to shoot the war again. So only after life apparently had dropped him did Curtin give him approval to work for other people. But then Life magazine and Silk was devastated. But then Life magazine, the executive editor, cabled him, "Come to New York. We're sending you to cover the war in Europe." So he covered the war in Europe, and again had an amazing life and death adventures during D-Day, the Battle of the Bulge. He was then sent to the Pacific and took the first picture of Nagasaki after the A-bomb was taken. So Life magazine valued him so much that they hired him and kept him on staff for the rest of the war. And he worked for Life until they closed down in 1972. But he was also hired by Sports Illustrated and all the major magazines. So as you say, he won Magazine Photographer of the Year four times, and was highly venerated by the Americans. He ended up with an American accent. He married in 1947 and settled in the US. But he loved the Australian troops that he'd worked with during World War II, so much so, even though he was a Kiwi, given the slightest opportunity, he would break into a Waltzing Matilda.
Isn't that amazing? And tell me if I'm wrong here, but I think, Silk's life, just amazing. And was he in Hawaii doing a surfing story when Life folded, or was that around that time?
He was in Europe, I think in Switzerland, in the Alps, and he gets a cable. The editors have decided to close down, the board's decided to close down the magazine. And he sends back a cable. Your message garbled. Send $500,000 in extra expenses. So he was a cheeky devil. George Strock continued to work. The American continued to work for Life magazine as well, but never quite as famous as Silk. But you mentioned President Roosevelt earlier. Yep. To get his photograph of the three dead Americans published, he and Life magazine kept going to the Pentagon. And their representative in Washington, D.C., went almost daily and knocking on doors to get approval to get this photograph published. And, of course, the Pentagon being the Pentagon, no, we're not approving that. And he went up the ranks. He started with a captain, then a major, then a lieutenant colonel, and a colonel, and a general, then an assistant secretary of for war. And he was finally told, you're going to have to take this to the White House. So they take it to the White House. And fortunately, Steve Early, the President Roosevelt's press secretary, was himself a former journalist, was in sympathy with their belief that the American public had to be shocked into getting behind the war. In the arms factories, the absenteeism rate was 20-25% or something, something of that nature. A lot of politicians were against being in the war, and they wanted to shock the American public into realizing, this is a tough struggle and we're not going to win it until the whole country gets behind it. So Early takes the photograph into President Roosevelt, and Roosevelt totally agrees with him because the Congress was dominated by the Republicans who fought him at every level throughout the war. So he approved its publication. So 7 months after Silk's Blind Soldier photograph appeared in Life published Strock's Three Dead Americans, and it created quite a reaction around America. A lot of newspapers came out and said, "This is disgusting. You can't show this." But even newspapers that opposed Roosevelt, including the Washington Post, got behind it and said, "No, we've got to accept realities of the war and get behind it." So in 2014, Time magazine said that Strock's shot of the three dead Americans was the photograph that won the war. I think that's a bit of a stretch, but a lot of historians have said that they really believe it shortened the war and therefore saved a lot of lives, because America really, after that, got behind the war.
I tend to agree from an observer's point of view, that did seem to change the focus in America, and one can't help but understand why when you see that graphic photo of the three dead Marines, I think it is, on the beach Incredible stuff. Incredible stuff. It helps, I guess, the truth of battle, Stephen, is well recorded in your book. And I guess that's what the two Georges were about.
Yes, yeah, they believed in truth in war. There's I put a quote in there from an American congressman. He was a Republican, actually, who said, the first casualty, famous quote, in war is truth. In Australia, Prime Minister Curtin actually cracked down, and he issued an order which prevented the publication of the famous blinded digger photograph. Which was used on posters for the Liberty Loan, which the war loan in Australia. Mm-hmm. But he cracked down and prevented it being published again. And he even prevented photographs being published of ambulances or the outside of hospitals. So he went quite the different direction from Roosevelt. He felt the Australian public couldn't take bad news and couldn't take the truth.
My goodness.
Whereas Roosevelt said, no, it's only with the truth that we can win the war. Andrei Sokolov, the Soviet, the famous Soviet scientist, said after the war that the greatest weapon in war is not the A-bomb, it's truth. So unfortunately, in Australia, we saw less and less truthful coverage of the war, where in America they began to see the naked truth of war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well said, well said. Too, Stephen, I think maybe exemplified with the Darwin bombing and the intrusion of Japanese mini subs in Sydney Harbour. I don't know if the whole truth was told of those incidents.
No. As you say, I gather that the Darwin story was pretty much suppressed. There were reasons to be careful about what was said. General MacArthur, after the Battle of the Coral Sea, one of his senior officers told a war correspondent that because they were rather pleased themselves that they'd beaten back the Japanese Navy, but one of these officers said to the war correspondent it was the result of good intelligence, and in fact. Where the Allies had broken the Japanese naval code, but MacArthur was furious because it didn't take a genius on the Japanese side to work out. I've said intelligence. We'd better look carefully at our own side to see whether there's a problem with our codes and so on. So after that, MacArthur banned senior officers. Allied officer from talking to the press without express permission from GHQ. So there were reasons to be careful, but I think preventing photographs of ambulances, et cetera, being published was just going too far.
Yeah, indeed. Quite ridiculous when you think about it. Okay. So, I mean, the two Georges were friends, you said. Did they ever meet in an LA bar, Stephen?
I have in my mind, I can see it happening. There's no record of it, but I'm sure it did. And it in the movie version, as you say, this is ripe for movie material. We are talking to documentary makers at the moment, so hopefully it'll progress to a movie one day. But in my movie version, we have the two Georges meeting in that LA bar, and who else should be there? But the DOI lady. In the book, I call her Peggy for want of another name.
Yeah.
Just saying, the anonymous lady. And it's possible that one or more of your listeners have a grandmother or great-grandmother who, after the war, said when they, someone might have been talking about the blind digger photograph, if it weren't for me, that would never have been published, So I'm hopeful at some point in the promotion for this book, someone's going to put up their hand and say, that was my grandmother or great-grandmother. I'd love to identify her and give her the credit, because if it had been found out that she'd got those prints and smuggled them to Silk, she would have been fired, without doubt, and possibly prosecuted under the very tight regulations that existed.
My God.
On circulation of photographs.
Yeah, my God, she took
and,
such
and
a
George
risk.
Silk, she absolutely did. And George Silk, as I said earlier, only revealed her involvement quite a long while after the war, and never revealed her name. But I think she should be praised for her pluck.
Indeed, another part of history that tells its own story. And if we can help in any way in getting some information and getting some news about that wonderful woman and her bravery in this instance. So, Stephen Dando Collins, thank you so much for speaking with the Last Post Radio Show podcast series about your amazing book, The Buna Shots, the amazing story behind two photographs that changed the course of World War II, a gripping narrative, as has been said, about the human spirit over seemingly unbeatable odds. So thank you so very much, Stephen.
Greg, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to Greg T. Ross and the Last Post Radio Show.